Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you're listening to. Welcome to the Controversial Exchange. We have a really cool episode. Before, though, I have a link down below to not one, but two free audiobooks, a free, like, just straight up free two audiobooks from Audible. I landed and secured this through the YouTube channel I run, the Daily BA, and since this is an extension of it, go check it out. Also, this is completely donation values based, so please consider linking or clicking the link down below and maybe supporting this as well if you're enjoying it. Now, today, what we have is good friend Kathy Fox jumps on. She works with Dimitri. I have a few notes for you beforehand. I accidentally say neural net instead of neural link at one point. You're going to catch that. Kathy's vocals, her and Dimitri are in the same room, so there's a little bit of echo going on. I did the best I could to kind of clean that up, get this out to you all. This is a little bit of a speculative episode. And what I mean by that is there's this huge world of data that you've probably never heard of. We want to orient you to that. More specifically, there's just so much data packed into this book that there's just so much to pull through that it leads you to all these different places of thinking, like the possibilities, and we're looking at it from a behavioral psychology lens or behavior analytic lens like we like to on the show. So just do me a favor, use that free audiobook to go check this out. I really think you're going to enjoy it. And also, this is so far beyond any sort of ivory tower coursework, anything you're experiencing like a grad program, unless you're in that world. So if you're in the psychology world, hopefully that's where you're from since you're listening to this. Yeah, this is going to be above and beyond where most people in that world are talking right now. But it has its roots. You can look into things like Cambridge Analytica. They were in the news a few years ago. It's all relevant. So with that said, we're going to just jump into this. Buckle up and let's roll that intro.
Okay, so I'm Kathy. I am the director of the academic programming at Hoglund Learning Center in Columbus. I work with Dimitri every day. And that must be hell. It's actually really wonderful. I'm going to say all nice things today because he let me come on the podcast and talk about this book. So
what's this book?
It's called Everybody Lies. And it was suggested to me by the Libby app for the Columbus Library because I listen to books when I'm on long drives or walking the dog a lot. And I just looked interesting. Everybody Lies, big data, new data, and what the internet can tell us about who we really are.
Who's the author again?
So, Seth Stevens Davidowitz.
And then I'm going to forward a link to a TED Talk if people want to see a little 16-minute snapshot of some of the data and some of the visuals that go with it, too. It's a pretty fascinating book.
Okay, sweet. I made it about halfway through.
Oh, yeah?
As fast as I could. I did not finish it. I have thoughts.
On a 13-hour drive, you couldn't finish it?
I got distracted with a bunch of other things that I was listening to as well. And then I ran out of service. I made the mistake of leaving cell service for like 5 hours without downloading it. So I was like, yeah. No, I timed this perfectly. So I just kind of raced through it. I think it's really fascinating. Can we get like a little bit of a synopsis maybe started for listeners before we dive into the details?
So
I can start a little bit. You can jump in. So I started listening to it and I probably was about an hour and a half in before I texted Dimitri and I was like, please read this with me. I'm definitely going to need to talk to somebody about it. I had no idea. I think from the very beginning, I was just learning so much. I didn't know all this data existed. It's basically discussing all of the data the internet has on us, what people are looking at, what maybe some of it means. It doesn't go into that a whole lot, but it's a unique look, I think, a different perspective than I'd ever heard of what we are doing on the internet and the differences between that and what we're doing in real life. So
it's behavioral engineering on a broad cultural scale. Yes. From humongous tech companies with profiteering motives in contrast to, actual social welfare. So just, we'll get to the dark side later.
Yeah, there's anyway. Definitely a dark side.
Yeah. Let's give I want to do a few.
There's definitely a dark side.
I want to do a few things. I want to give some examples first that we thought were pretty cool from the book or that we've seen in our own life. And then let's talk about like what data, big data is and how they talk about data and then see where that takes. Is that cool?
Yeah,
this book is like, what's great is we've talked about big data on the podcast a couple different times, but we've just kind of glossed over it. And if anyone is interested in like really understanding kind of some of the detailed metrics and how they're used and just what kind of bizarre things and counterintuitive leaps you can get. It's definitely recommended. But let's just dive into a little bit and get an idea of what it is. So let's define that so we're coming up with the same operational definition. So shoot. So, yeah.
All right. So you want me to start with some of the things I found? Interesting, right?
Yeah.
I'm just going to jump right into it because you said I can talk about anything.
Anything you want.
So the porn data was highly alarming to me. It was, I had no idea. And I unfortunately deal with a lot of teenage boys in porn in my life. And so I'm already pretty disturbed on a regular basis. Not right now because, you know, it's summer and the kids aren't mostly in school, but I could not believe what I was hearing when I started listening to it.
What about the number of incestuous searches in porn categories?
Right, that's what I was saying.
Like, yeah.
Incest.
It was like, what, 15? It was like 15%, I think.
Yeah, 14 or 15, I think.
Yeah. Of internet porn searches were
porn.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Porn.
Incestuous in nature. A lot of the one that I still can't believe is what was happening in India with an obscene amount of people Googling how to breastfeed from their wives or how to get their wives to let them breastfeed from them. It was only India, which I find fascinating and I don't know anything about it. It was very specific to India.
First of all,
I didn't know about this. I didn't even know it existed.
So like this data sets came from searches. The two places he drew data from were from Google searches and from Pornhub searches. And Pornhub is the largest collection of pornography in the world on the internet. It has swallowed the industry. Pretty much something like 90% of pornographic traffic on the internet goes through Pornhub. So imagine a $7 billion industry just in America, forget globally,
right,
and what that looks like as far as day-to-day use and day-to-day contact. So like we're talking about millions and millions and millions, almost billions of views and clicks and searches that contributed to the aggregation of these results. So this is not like weird small sample sizes. This is global search results, just to be clear.
And they also, yeah. And so then they pulled from Google as well. And he, every once in a while, will reference like a different search website, like a Bing or something, but very, very rarely because Google, their differentiator and why everyone says Google it instead of Bing it or Yahoo it or whatever is because they figured out how to curate good quality links. I'm going to say that in air quotes because there is some ways constantly with SEO strategies to try to hack that. But that's why it's so much so pulling from the Google search rankings. And so, what they're doing is they're taking data from there and they're essentially looking at correlations, right? And they're trying to figure out what you can do with those correlations. Are there causal relations? He's, I think, a really good writer and making sure that he's not creating those causal relations there. Right.
Yeah, he definitely does so a couple things. So he doesn't necessarily talk about causality. That's right. Definitely not the case. But he does demonstrate strong correlational relationships amongst those searches and particular types of outcomes. We'll get back to the Pornhub stuff just because it's the fun, juicy shit. But like for this thing, though, like specifically some singular things are like suicide rates and how certain types of Google searches in a particular area are linked to an immediate increase to suicidality. Some other one was racism, actually. So yeah. that was probably one of the most interesting ones was that when Barack Obama was president, searches for the N-word spiked dramatically. And you could predict geographically where those searches occurred to what the type of voting, what the voting blocks would do. So it was, and also how the different outcomes for people of color were in those areas, right? So like African Americans would make less money in those areas or something like that, and variety of other statistical relationships. So like Google results told the truth. The whole premise of this book is basically that all social science is based on surveys, and surveys lie, and people lie
to surveys.
No one wants to tell the truth. No one wants to expose their inner self. But you know what doesn't lie? Your Google search history. Because when you're alone with your computer, you know, that's the most likely you're going to try to feed your brain with whatever rotten candy entertainment you're going to have, and also when you're going to touch yourself.
And he's pretty good.
That's the whole premise.
And he's pretty good at acknowledging, you know, with a Google search data point, that might be somebody that's searching on someone else's phone or on behalf of somebody else or like whatnot. So what we're talking about with big data here is these essentially kind of like my interpretation, correct me if I'm wrong, y'all, but was these larger data sets. They aren't defined by like a certain number. He's pretty clear about that. But they're things that once weren't available that through sensors, technology, and tools and whatnot are now vastly available to us.
So it's about sample size, right? So big data is about sample size. And it's also about the inadvertent bias that gets built in the sample sizes from like as a result of controlled trials from social scientific experiments. And what this is just a free for all of every single person on the planet that's using that engine or whatever, that service.
And people might be thinking right now,
colored by that.
If you're not thinking right now, you should be thinking about the implications of this, like in a capitalistic system, because he talks about how people leverage this. There's companies that are trying to get this information to people as fast as they possibly can. They sell it and they make decisions off of it. The horse racing one was a great example of that, right?
That's a great story.
Where there was a horse that was up for bid. One of the industry standard was that people would come in that were like strong histories, strong roots in being racers themselves and being a part of these sort of farms and families and whatnot. And then this tech firm comes in with some people from like Harvard, MIT, I can't remember exactly what it was. And they say, yeah, this horse, which was the one that the guy was putting up for sale, he's like, do not sell that horse. Based off the analytics, and the guy actually bought his own horse back, and it was the one that won the Triple Crown a few years ago
under a pseudonym. I think he used a different name.
Yes. Yeah, he used a fake name to buy that his horse.
About it.
Yeah, so people wouldn't make fun of him if it went bad. Yeah,
and so yeah, there's so many angles to this. Yeah, so
well, as a result, well, what's nice about that? So the counterintuitive stuff. So like, let's take that horse example from beginning to end. This guy wanted to get into horse racing, had no background in it from like a familial, and usually it's kind of like a close-knit group or for people with money, right? But he did have a belief that there were measurements and objective things that he could find, like data points that he could collect that would be honest predictors of how horses would perform. Because up until now, or up in recent history and overall history of horse racing, it's a very intuitive thing. It actually made me think of Moneyball, that movie Moneyball that they made of Brad Pitt.
He mentions it, I think, in the book.
Does he? I don't remember if he mentioned it or not. Yeah. But it made me think of the exact same type of thing in Moneyball where it's like all these people focus on all these bizarre intangibles that are kind of superstitious, you know? It's
very
like,
superstitious.
And especially with horses, it was this whole thing about just the way they would run or like and that kind of thing. And he found basically the single metric for horses was their ability, like the breathing power. So if they would be out of breath and their heart rate would their heart size would hit a certain point, that means they're a winner or a loser, and all the other superstitious stuff like gait or whatever was completely dismissed, and as a result, he's produced more winners than anybody.
Yeah, it was the size of their ventricle was one of the leading predictors.
That's
right,
ventricle, right.
It's fascinating.
So
right?
pretty fascinating stuff to think about how that kind of like data metric can come alive. But back to the big data thing, it's just unbelievable how, you know, just even as early as like 25 years ago, 20 years ago, even really 15, even with Facebook, like this stuff really hasn't been around in that way. And I remember when Google became like a thing, and it was like my freshman year, my roommate turned me on to it. And that was 2001 in college.
Oh, wow.
So that's the earliest I can remember using Google. So Google for me has been around for 18 years.
I don't think I was using that early.
Yeah.
I was in college in 2001 and I don't remember.
I had a computer science nerd as my
guy. I remember it myself. So. Yeah.
Yeah.
So like that's the first time. So in 18 years, we've gone from like big data really not existing to between social media and all these search engines, being able to create all these different predictive models that can meet people's needs without them even knowing it subconsciously. That's that behavior. That's that behavioral piece to it. Some of the other interesting things, I mean, man, there was just really so much stuff. What was some of the other stuff that you liked?
It got me thinking in terms of social contingencies and how powerful they can be. Like you were saying, you don't lie to Google. You don't lie to Pornhub.
Yeah.
You do lie to surveys. Even if they're, quote unquote, anonymous, the way people behave in public is very different. That's the whole point of it. How powerful are they? Are we using them to the best of our abilities? You know, I don't know. It's very interesting to think about the power that social contingencies hold over people and what they'll do to kind of present the right behavior in a public forum and go home and do something completely different.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Something really interesting from that last year at that Convergence conference that we ran, Joe Lang was talking about how there is a company, presumably not based in the US, but he wasn't able to disclose a lot of story stuff. And they traditionally employed talk therapists, and they were out there to try to help people with traditional talk therapy sorts of things when it comes to mental health. And they were doing an AI test of having robots actually like interact socially through an app with somebody to help them out. And at the end of their initial trial study, they were not only doing better than the humans were on outcomes, they were preferred over the people that were going through it as well.
Oh, man, because their responses were perfect.
Yep.
The contingencies are perfect in technology, right? They are perfect. You cannot error in that sort of sense. And it just gets better and better and better. But the social part, it made me like remember that talk when I was listening to it, because I was like, oh, maybe this is like something that's going on there. It's like people will be lying in front of the other person, no matter who you are, right? When you're talking with your talk therapist. So not that we can draw that, those sort of things between those two points I just suggested, but that's the sort of implications that these things have and like where your thought processes go and where the data can maybe lead us to some sort of answers or more clarity at least.
Yeah, but I think it does kind of highlight the reality of most of the work that we do, and that we rely on, aside from our own observation, we rely on outside reports. We rely on people to tell us the truth so we can help them. You know, it's hard to come up with something without talking to people, but the reality is they put their best foot forward. I mean, I was thinking about it like, you know, pretty much when you're talking to strangers, even though it's not a job interview, people are acting like it is. You know, you withhold. You don't expose yourself completely.
You want to like, look as good as possibly as you possibly can every time.
Every time.
So it was like, this was kind of a fascinating illumination. And like the porn stuff was fascinating mostly because like the amount of taboo, you know, like publicly. And the interesting, so back to the, so one of the data points that was great and hilarious was on the condom usage, right?
Oh yeah.
Wasn't that great?
Yes.
So like the idea was like they asked women, how many times a week they have sex and how many condoms they used. And I think the numbers were about 1.1 billion condoms a year is what it shook out to be if you did the math. And it was about one time a week, right? And then they asked men, and I think men were something like three times a week, and about like almost 2 billion condoms total. But then they looked at the actual industry analytics, and about only half a billion condoms get sold total in a year.
Everybody's lying about how much sex they're having.
Everybody, exactly. So no one's having as much sex as they actually are having. And it's just like, you wonder, like, all these different social, all these different studies and all these different, I don't know, ideas that we base a lot of statistical models on, a lot of public policy.
Yes.
All these various metrics.
A lot of what we do at work.
Yeah. All these metrics, like, are they bullshit? You know what I mean? Are they just, are they measuring the fake reality and not actually what's going on in the world? And man, this whole book is just an example of one counterintuitive thing after one counterintuitive thing after one counterintuitive thing, which is like really, really awesome.
I think it also speaks to the power of belief. We talk about that so much. People, a lot of it seems superstitious to me, but the people, they don't want to know. The information can be right there. I like the example about basketball players. You guys remember that one? Did you catch that one? Well, everybody, a lot of people think that NBA players are coming up from these bad, really poor neighborhoods with parents, you know, dad in jail, I think was one of the things everybody, they think they're all like LeBron James. And the reality is they come, the vast majority of them come from upper middle class households who can afford to train them and make sure they get good grades and get college scholarships.
And nutrition, all that stuff.
All of those things. And people will repeatedly insist that the NBA is full of LeBron James type people, and that's not true. The data is there. They don't want to talk about it. I think everything that is in this book is a good example of that. We can find information. I don't know if people put it together. I was telling Dimitri earlier, I didn't put it together. I was telling him I just learned from you last year about what liking things on Facebook does. Like, I didn't know that that helped people I was following. I had no idea. I just thought it was there for me to, you know, give you a little internet high five. I had no idea.
That it is like the currency of social media.
I had no clue until you told me. That's why I use it as currency now. I really try to like things that are important to me instead of just mindlessly scrolling. But I didn't know that was a thing.
Yeah. One thing you reminded me of is I was talking with another behavior analyst about social media and just how fast things move outside of our field. The YouTube algorithm, the most up-to-date, like accurate information I found is that it's updating every 5 seconds for every user continually. So it's always making some sort of database decision over what you watched. It is absolutely insane and scary how much data they have at the end of the day. And it's funny. It makes you wonder why things like Google and YouTube are free, right? It's because those interactions and what we're doing are way, 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 way more valuable than we think.
Oh, dude, Google. First of all, Google started out, their moniker was Don't Be Evil. And in the last 3 years, they removed that, by the way. So everybody was wondering, like, their mission statement.
I was not aware of that.
Yeah, their actually mission statement had Don't Be Evil in it. And they overtly removed that. Like, their lawyers were like, you need to take that out because you're kind of being evil now. So just a heads up there for everybody who's wondering. Additionally, there's a file, and I can't remember where it is, but I can confirm that I did this with my own file. And Google has the largest one. Facebook has the second largest. And I believe, I want to say.
Oh, did you request for your file?
I went to it. Absolutely.
Yeah, okay. You can just
15 gigs. 15 gigs.
I'm not looking at my file. I'm good.
First of all. So here's what's scary about this. They basically NSA your fucking phone and use all your shit against you. There was 3 gigabytes of 10-second audio clips of me randomly, like, throughout my day, where they tap your microphone and take that data under the guise as using it for better voice recognition.
Yeah.
And, like, there was me calling someone an asshole making a left turn because they cut me off. Like... I mean, I'm just like, oh my God, I cannot have this information out in the world. Like, I need privacy. When I'm screaming at somebody on the highway and I'm alone in my car, that's my special place. Like, that's the time where I can act ridiculous, tell people to go fuck themselves and not feel like in jeopardy of, like, being called a terrible person. And this is bullshit that now Google is going to leverage that against me one day. So,
or they're going to sell it to somebody.
Or they're going to sell it to somebody. Exactly. Yeah. So it's
Which
pretty scary.
More likely
and
scenario.
If you're ever wondering, if you're talking about something and all of a sudden now you get ads, it's real.
It is
that's,
real.
That's
it's
how
happening.
They get you. It's but real.
I have a question about that because we were talking about it. Do you think people care though? Are you going to stop having your phone on in the car so you can swear at everybody on the interstate? No.
Well, here's what I did. I actually went into my permissions and I changed it so it doesn't record me anymore. At least I hope so. I haven't checked it since, but I did click that thing where it's like, no more, motherfuckers.
Yeah, there's.
I don't know if people care enough because it's. It's on such a, the big data is it's group data. It's not individualized. If somebody wants to, they know, you know, I can like something on Facebook. I did understand that would increase the amount of times I would see something and that Facebook kind of curated ads and so forth. They were selling my information, but I didn't realize I could lie on Facebook and go Google something and they have all that information.
Somebody can find it.
Yeah. And I don't know. One, people know that, and two, if they would care. I think people are too ingrained in things like social media, using the internet. I think they're really willing to say fuck it.
Well, here's two questions. First of all, who doesn't have a Gmail address?
Nobody. No. Our work email is Gmail.
I know, exactly.
Everybody uses Gmail.
Secondly, when's the last time you read a terms of service?
Never. Ever? I've never read one.
If you've read terms, get out.
And now this is going to be on the internet and people are going to start sending me shit because I just admitted I don't read anything. That's great.
I only read the Anchor one because I was getting more interested in these. I'm talking like top to bottom because someone was saying that it was like a really bad terms of service. It's where we host our podcast through. But it turns out that the clauses they include are in almost everything else out there, social media wise as well. And I would never read another again. I've not read every other one in my life though.
I have never read a term.
That was just for like a research purpose of like, is this really that bad? I've never read one.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know anybody who does read them. And they bank on that.
Well, the alternative is pay for everything, right?
Right.
So it's either basically you're held hostage. Give your information for free so we can sell it. Or we're going to charge you $10 a month for your email. We're going to charge you $5 a month for Facebook. We're going to charge you $3 a month for Twitter. We're going to, you know, it's like Instagram. Everything will have to cost money because then where else does our revenue come from? But on the inverse of that, so there's an interesting argument about the economics of data, right? And how this is going in terms of like as AI gets more sophisticated, and we'll talk about some of this stuff too, and how different machinery and different software is going to get so sophisticated. Back to your example with the idea that like, robots are better counselors, You know what I mean? So robots are coming for your job. But anyway, so the idea that at some point in time when everything gets automated, what will be the commodity left that people have to sell and leverage if they can no longer sell their time to make money? Right? Because at some point in time, machines don't consume. The engines of capitalism are consumption. So humans will still have to consume even if they're not even if they're not in the job market. So what will be the commodity? And since we've already given our data for free, they're talking like there's a whole movement actually about reforming the way that data is collected and the control that you can have all your privacy and your data so that you can actually leverage it to make money off of it. Because it's potentially going to be the future currency of the world.
Yeah, because all. But in the meantime, this is why Google and them are on a fucking complete rat race to get every available piece of useful information. Because by the time they get that, right, then you don't have the leverage anymore. Like, these people have so much leverage in that game, it is completely unfathomable. Like, there's a reason that the government doesn't talk about regulating them. And like, here's a good example. Trump goes into office. What did he do? He talked with Elon Musk. He talked with Larry Page. He talked with the owner of Twitter. Like,
Zuckerberg.
They bring all of them in immediately. There's pictures out there. It was like day one or two where they all sit down, right? Because you can't, you can't compete with these sort of people on the scale that's run right now. There's the capital that they have on top of that to make stuff happen is unreal. There was a tweet, I can't remember what it was, but it was something that it was from a guy named Marquez Brownlee. He does MKBHD is his YouTube channel. And he was talking about when it was about 6-8 months ago when it was 1 trillion was like the cap that was hit by Apple. You could buy at the time.
1 trillion what? Dollars?
Yeah. It was something effective. You users. Could, it was something effective that you could buy like every.
Sales?
That's their market value, like what their company's valued at.
Okay. Oh, $1 trillion.
What they have that they could potentially use. And it was something effective that they could buy every NFL, NBA, MLB team that was out there. They could buy something stupid like 100,000 Teslas and some other things, and like they still have cash left over. Like the size of these companies don't seem as big as sometimes people think that they are. And like
Gotham, man.
Like, I hope they're listening to this and they're just like, ha, those chumps kind of get it, but they're like 20 years late to the game. Cause that's what they should be doing, right?
I mean, the robot is going to completely discard us anyway. He'll do.
We're all wasting our time.
Yeah, dude. I'm obsessed with Jeopardy, and they finally added old episodes to Netflix. So I've been going back, and I forgot that they had done this, but they did the IBM episodes where they did a 3-part series with Ken Jennings, that guy who won like $2 million, and some other champion who won a couple $1 million versus Watson, the computer. And Watson devastated them.
Oh, yeah.
And this is like 11, 12 years ago AI, right? So this is basically just a search engine with a voice. This isn't like thing that's actually like doing neural net thinking like on its fucking own type shit.
Not the AI of today.
Yeah, this is not like almost a human being, but like without biology. And it beat these guys who, the guy won 74 days in a row at one point, right? And he beat him by $40,000.
Yeah.
And it was wrong a couple times. Like, that's how, I mean, absolutely terrifying it is. And actually, potential preview. So, like, we've been talking about maybe putting together this paper, like, how did behavior analysis become a factory job? Like, how did we automate ourselves just in terms of, like, the task list and just in general? And I keep thinking about, like, what happens? Is it possible to get to the point where these types of data metrics come into play? And really the idea of analyzing behavior is irrelevant because the data sets are so big and the ability to aggregate them is there on a grand scale from machines who don't have any limitations that will just be able to spit out answers for any type of question that you have and be able to correct and engineer whatever responses they want. So I don't know. I keep thinking about like how far is that future and if it's real and if it's going to be happening.
You know what's crazy is the late 60s, early 70s Behavior Bank by Ogden Lindsley was him trying to do that 50 years ago, yeah. 50 years ago.
It's also, have you guys read the Time article with B.F. Skinner on the cover? We Can't Afford Freedom.
Nope. Forever ago. I don't remember it at all.
I mean,
tell me about it.
It's predictive of what you just said. I mean, it's going to happen for us. We're going to get to the point where our knowledge of behavior will allow us to engineer humans.
Yeah.
And what are the good things and the bad things about it?
Man, do we want that?
It's inevitable. I mean,
like, there's no choice, right?
Yeah, I think the point is it's coming. And
do you think that would lead into a Luddite revolt where people go anti-technology full tilt? Yes. And like fuck this shit. Like,
yeah, I think that's what's being attempted with the Area 51 storming that's being planned.
Dude, and
they're gonna learn real quick that you don't do that. You can't overturn that.
do you believe they were like, just to be clear, we know this is a joke, but just in case you weren't joking, you're gonna get shot on sight.
Yeah. We will murder. So there's a few relevant things here. OpenAI.org or .com, I can't remember, is a nonprofit. Elon Musk is involved. He for a long time was speaking against Google. He would never say them, but everybody knows that he's talking about that he was speaking against Google because of their direction of being able to possibly use it for evil. So there is some really cool resources and like people that are involved on that. If people want to read up more or get involved, I think they do a lot of their work crowdsourcing. So if there's programmers out there, like you can hop on and be a part of that. The other one was last week, he and the team announced to talk about neural net, which is fucking insane and relevant.
Which
to
is
this.
The Matrix.
What
it's
they're,
the Matrix.
Yeah, so,
I don't know what it is.
Okay,
it's a fucking
so,
Matrix.
So what they're trying to do is see if they can integrate computers with the human brain to be able to provide us with the ability to leverage AI and at the end of the day be equal to AI rather than being subordinate to it and just being slaves of it. So what they're trying to do...
I think the combination of human-robot is better than robot.
Yeah, so listen to this. They're trying
basically,
to...
Basically, yes, they're, cyborgs.
They're
yes.
trying to, by the end of 2020, this is the fucking crazy part of this, have an FDA trial going where they have 1,000 nodes that are implanted into your brain that allow you to start interacting with computers in that sort of way.
I watch the news every night. I don't think this was on it.
Yes, yeah, it's like deep-seated.
Yeah, people
like
are not there. Talking about this.
Yeah.
Lester Holt did not mention it.
Some caveats, like when this stuff comes out, like that's an ambitious as hell timeline, and there's always those caveats of like we'll run into something or the government will freak out and whatnot, but that's
I
like
mean, worst case scenario, they can afford to go on a private island in international waters and not worry about
they've
what the
yeah and say. They've yeah and then they just have to start dealing with international treaties and like weird agreements and stuff.
They don't care. They'll buy a weirdo island and have a whole island of Dr. Moreau situation.
Maybe that's why they're trying
like,
to go to the moon so bad in Mars. Like there are no laws there. We can just go do whatever we want. So it's a fascinating world that is not on most scientists or even behavioral scientists or behavior analysts' radar, I don't think. On
well, let's ask the question, though.
Oh,
answer the question.
Well, hold on.
Would you hook yourself up?
Would I?
Yeah.
Dude, I would seriously consider it. Like, I would be looking at the list of, like, possible side effects, but yeah. Dude, we live in an opportunity. We live in the time and age where you could do that. Like, you could do that. Like, would you sign up for the space race and blast yourself to the moon? Hell yeah.
That is not the same thing. That is not
it's
same.
Not the same thing.
Why, dude?
It's... No.
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 Why not?
Those are different things.
We were uncertain about, though, what would happen on both of these. Go ahead.
We just talked about how they already know everything we're doing because we don't lie to our computers and our phones. If you let them put electrodes in your brain, they're really going to know.
Yeah, you have no secrets.
There will be none left. And if that's the risk. You're going to evaluate it. I can appreciate that you would consider it, but... No secrets for you.
But you will have the best Facebook profile ever.
The Matrix becomes real. I could go to bed and wake up and be able to Naruto run. Like, I could potentially...
So let me get this straight. You would take the blue pill and enjoy the steak and learn Kung Fu fast.
I would sit down and draw out a pro-con list, and I would listen to that doctor. And I'd be like, okay, what am I potentially running into here? Dude, seriously, like, how cool would that be? Have you all seen...
I think it would be cool to watch somebody else, but I don't want to do it. So if you do it,
are you talking about like Ready Player One?
Yeah, this is Ready Player No. One. Like we're creeping
No.
up to
No,
it.
It's, dude, Ready Player One is more like total immersion fantasy. What they're talking about is actual biological integration of technology with humans. Like, this is the singularity we've talked about before.
Yeah, so it turns out that Ready Player One wasn't quite right. It turns out we have to just
The Matrix is more right.
Yeah.
The Matrix was more right. That's what That's scarier, dude. That's a huge needle going into the back of your brain so you can download how to use every machine gun on the planet. Like, that makes
all right, he's going to make no a pros and cons list first. He's yeah. going to really think it through. Yeah. It'll be fine.
I've always wanted to fly a helicopter in 5 minutes, so I mean, I guess that's a good thing.
it yeah, could be absolutely insane. What were you going to say, Kathy?
Do you think, though, that if that were a real option, do you think people would sign up? Do you think? I mean, I think there's always going to be a few crazies who would legit be like, yeah, just you can get in my brain.
Ryan's gonna sign up.
He's first
gonna, guy in line.
He's gonna make a list first, though. So I'm gonna give he's him a little bit of that. Yeah, there are people who are gonna be like, yeah, I want the fame that comes with something like that, because we also live in a world where that's valued over a lot of things.
I don't have the money to be first in line, so I would be looking at like how many people died out of the first like 1 million that got this before me or whatever. You know,
first round go and then you
yeah, go like there's a yeah. lot of. There's gonna be some data to look at, but would I jump on that train with the way I think that things are gonna go? Pretty sure, yeah. Why not? What's the alternative? Be the Luddite that like just gets surpassed by AI?
Man, I don't know. I guess yes. Well, go. I will not go gentle into that good night, dude. Fuck the machines.
When you really think about what people are open to, when you say human behavior engineering, people freak out, right?
Yeah.
They don't realize it's already happening.
Oh, it's
happening. And even with, yeah, it's.
They your don't, Amazon search, yeah. your Amazon shopping list, the reason it keeps getting bigger is because they know. They know what you want. They know what you like.
I just got a new Fire that has Alexa on it, and they're just going to start sending me shit.
Yeah, Alexa sucks.
She's an evil woman. She's a.
I love it.
Hold on. I shouldn't have said that.
Bring it.
Woman robot.
Alexa, I love you. Don't listen to me.
I find that the people who talk about it don't realize. They're people who don't realize it's already happening. Like I said, I had no idea half of the shit that's in this book was a thing. I had never heard of Google Trends. Never. Had no idea. And I mean, I knew that like if somebody looked at my search history, they would see that I'm like overly into serial killers, and that might concern people. I get that kind of thing. Nobody wants their search history looked at, but I don't think people really know that you're already being engineered.
Oh, absolutely.
Your environment does that with or without your consent.
Yeah.
It's happening around you. I don't know. I think people would complain about it, but I don't think people would really give up their internet use. I don't think they give up Instagram. I don't think they'll give up Facebook. Snapchat, all of it, Twitter.
No. And I occasionally listen to people talk about this from behavior analysis that are in, like, they try to warn about the implications of social media, and they're almost always completely fucking outdated. There's never a conversation around like, oh, Google's tracking things that could be HIPAA class information as you're walking around, right? Because you have your settings turned on. No one even realizes that's even a thing, yeah. right? Nobody realizes it. Like our fields,
and it's stored.
Our fields, the organizers up above to the people within, nobody gets it.
It can record Dimitri in his car yelling at people. It can record us talking about clients or students.
Oh, yeah.
It definitely is, yeah. Nobody thinks about it that way. And they talk about it on a, you know, how much are we in the field behaviorally engineering people? And people get really, it happens with or without us.
Oh, we're modifying everything constantly.
It's happening. People, I don't think when it pushes to shove, I don't think they'll care that much.
So one interesting thing is sometimes in our fields talking about like, will there be some sort of cure or pill, air quotes, for autism? What Neuralink's trying to do is trying to understand behavioral disorders. Like that's one of their primary areas of research. They're going to try to understand like what's going on. Because we know that the brain is not the sole central thing that matters when we're talking about the environment and genetics and all this sort of stuff. But when you compare that concept of how much data they could collect and what's going on in there, holy cow, will there be some new potential implications of those sort of things, right?
Would it be easier to do that than change some environments? I think that's a valid argument.
Yeah, it's just an electrode in the right spot.
Yeah.
Like you said, the brain's not the only thing. Maybe it's the easiest thing to change.
Full circle back to electroshock, just targeted, right? Is that like the cyber knife of electroshock? Is that what we're talking about here? Oh, man. I'm out.
Yeah, so I mean, just the insights, what we learned from that book is just that the insight enough, it can be so valuable for what to do next. And us as pragmatic scientists, something like that could be shifting our field overnight if when they start going, because they'll collect so much data so quickly that it could be teased out and allow us to move forward. It's going to...
Well, another thing that's interesting is that they give a... You actually can use a lot of the data yourself if you really wanted to put the effort in, because you have access to Google Trends.
Yeah, you can access, find it.
Yeah, they give you... You can search all these different things if you are patient enough and know how to use the tools. So then the question lies is that, like, is it a restriction of our paradigm, like experimental and all that stuff, where we wouldn't even consider using these kind of data points because they wouldn't be direct measures and they wouldn't be single subject? And they, you know what I mean? Like,
you know, an interesting company is Answers Now out of Virginia. We had them talk at our conference last weekend, and what they're doing is they're trying to create, or they are creating, they've got $1 million of funding now, to create a app that allows clinicians to work with parents completely through a social app. Texting is the medium right now. Okay. And one of the biggest complaints from behavior analysts is like, oh, you're not directly observing things. One of the best counters that he had to that was, when's the last time you as a behavior analyst made a decision based off some observations that you saw with your own eyes? And it wasn't somebody else's observations or some sort of inference based off somebody else's somebody's observations.
I mean, I can say that almost every time for me, but I guess I'm old school.
We're in a different environment too. Yeah. We're there.
Yeah, I guess.
How many analysts out there do you think are really observing every data point and making a decision off of those?
Yeah, or not just every data point. Enough? Not every data point, but there should be at least a certain sample that you're observing.
Yeah.
See, like, like my response to that question, like, I totally get that counter, like, how many people are actually doing this? So who gives a shit?
Yeah, and it doesn't rest. I mean, but
that's the wrong question, right? The right question is, why aren't they doing that? Because they should be. But again, like, I'm going to take that position, and it's really irrelevant, because when it boils down to it, a technology like this is going to make people's lives easier and doesn't make them do more work. So lowest amount of response effort to maximize the amount of outcome, they're going to do that shit, because beings are inherently lazy. Like, it's
and
just,
if they can, if they can create the same or better outcomes with something that's different like that, that's scalable, they can meet the demand in some sort of way. And it might not be an encompassing treatment package, right? The data is going to guide them. And I think that's what's so exciting about possibilities like that. And dude, it's hard to get people to really see the potential implications until you start to really dive into a book like this and like relook and audit your life in a sense, right?
Oh, absolutely.
I have a question for you guys. Do you think we can't, is there anything we can do, humans in general can do, you know, we were talking to change it.
Burn it down
and start
straight
over.
Straight Fight Club.
Are we too far gone? We have a history. Now people, they're not on it in real life or in surveys, and they are with their computers. Is there anything we can do to change it? To stop this kind of big data taking over? Because it's,
I mean, like,
I don't know.
Outside of a violent coup that just like decides to like completely unsubscribe and like log off.
Yeah, we're too far gone.
Straight is the only way this stops.
I mean, so there's a little bit of a YouTube trend for people to start taking breaks and delete their apps and whatnot over the last year. And every major follower, every major person that I subscribed to took a break, came back, and was like, you know what? I'm going to use it for certain contexts. I can't completely get off of these sort of things. And it's clear that the social contingencies, I think, drive our behavior to some extent. So I don't really see that pragmatically being a solution, like everybody just quits these sort of things, unless some sort of cataclysmic event happens where there's a complete breach of everybody's data that causes some, you mean, like, you need such horrible consequences to be to affect everybody's life simultaneously. Like, I don't see that sort
of
stuff.
I just read an article about what you just said, that influencers do that on Instagram to make people wonder where they went. Like, it's a ploy to get people to engage more. So they'll be like, oh, I'm clearing my head, I'm going to turn off my social media. And then people go psycho without them there. But when they come back, they get 1,000 more hits, likes, whatever.
Yeah, I've seen
millions. It's extinction, dude.
And I could
that's
be,
what I'm saying. Like, it's a ploy.
Yeah. It could be. I could see it. I'm sure, like most behavior, like there's different functions for it. Right. And I would be willing to bet that I could see some of the people that I've watched on the internet do that. But I've also had folks where they're just like, it's clear that like their channel is just kind of like becoming this like it's kind of like the spiral of like the content's just not great, and it's just like they're clearly like inundated with just like shit in their life, and it's And some of them, it's kind of like, hey, I'm going to fix these sort of things. Who knows? I bet you the author of the book knows the answer to this.
I'll say that about this podcast. So, I mean, just like we just took like 3 weeks off, 4 weeks off-ish. And I needed it, man, because balancing my life and school and my job and a baby and then like making sure that you're properly read for something like this and not wanting to look like an idiot in front of people when you're going to post this publicly, like the stress starts to mound. And if you like one or two disappointing conversations over time accumulate and like you just start getting real bitter, like it's just what it is because the social contingencies are strong. You don't want to be embarrassed.
Right.
All the other stuff. And like this isn't a channel of millions of people. Imagine a couple like 500,000-700,000 subscribers. A million subscribers where 200,000 people are watching you on an every 3 day basis.
Yeah.
Like there is that, dude, the exponential pressure of that.
Yeah, that's true.
Is a there's totally a, different animal.
A break is warranted. Yeah. I would argue.
Yeah.
There's a YouTuber, Shane Dawson, that's been doing a lot of controversial series on YouTube. He uploads every like 3 to 4 months on average. He uploaded one that was on a very controversial sort of topic and on a YouTuber that took a break. I definitely consider checking out. We can link it in the show notes. But it was 21 million views after the first three days, I think, or something like that. Like, I'll pull it up real quick. It is a YouTuber that... never stated that she did or did not have some sort of eating disorder, but everyone thought she did based on her appearance. And so she took a break off social media for like 4 months or something like that. So 5 days, 24 million views. So it's tapering off, right? And it's called The Return of Eugenia Cooney. I believe that's... might be a different one. I don't know. This is a very young YouTuber that's dealt with a lot of shit on the internet since we're talking about it. So if I were to like kind of rewind back into your original question, Kathy, like where do you see this sort of stuff going? I don't think people mass unsubscribe from things like that, really. Like that might be one alternative. But I do think that... you'll see more regulation in some ways, not that the regulation ever like keeps up fast enough, but people like the open AI, more people trying to push their resources into like, how do we ethically interact with these sort of things and what should we be doing? So I'm kind of like hoping for an open AI platform to do
Microsoft just put $1 billion into it. So
what's that?
Microsoft just put $1 billion in open AI like this past couple days. Microsoft.
I didn't see that.
Yeah, they put $1 billion in OpenAI. I'm like so scared of it. I follow it like crazy. Like it's almost like conspiracy theorists crazy. Like I'm just like, holy shit, the robots are coming.
They are coming, though.
Yeah, it was funny.
It's not that far off. They're coming. I know,
dude. It's not good.
Well, what do you think about using it in general? Because one of my first thoughts, like initially I was like, holy shit, there's all this data out there that we're not using. Could we use it? And then I was kind of like, oh, well, should we use it? Is this okay to kind of invade privacy like this? So many people don't know. I don't know. I go back and forth. I think there was a couple of examples in the book. One was about, I think it was pancreatic cancer or liver cancer or something. One of those really quickly fatal cancers. And they were able to correlate. Yeah.
And triple their outcomes. Yeah.
By Google searches for symptoms.
Yeah.
They were able to kind of narrow it down, which is, I think, really important. In that case, you can make an argument that that is really important.
Absolutely.
The other case was the child abuse. Do you remember? I think it was in maybe Alabama, Mississippi. Do you guys remember that one?
No.
So there was they thought they did something, and I can't remember if it was like a piece of legislation or some sort of program they rolled out, and they thought that child abuse was going down. And what happened was people weren't reporting it. They were,
oh, that's right.
They were Googling things like, oh, my mom hits me or something. Those searches went up, but reports went down, which is a huge problem. And I feel like we should absolutely use those data to, you know, change how we talk to professionals about how they're reporting, what they should look for. But at the same time, people do that in the privacy. They don't, in the privacy of their homes, they're not lying to Google.
Well, that's the thing. That's the whole thing about what's the defining conversation of our age, right?
Right.
And like privacy is the 21st, 22nd century question, you know, last century it was about property rights and individual freedoms and speech. This century is supposed to be about privacy and like what right do you have to it? What ownership do you have over it? You know, to what degree are you able to protect it? What does privacy even mean? Like, what are the real boundaries of privacy? Right. You know what
I mean? Is it different in this age? You can't tell. We don't know if it's a, you assume if it says, is my mom hitting me? You assume that's a child. Do they have the same rights? I don't know.
Y'all remember when Zuckerberg I feel like 3 or 4 years into Facebook, and there was a picture of him that went viral, and it was him like a bunch of different computers, and his computer was there. There's like stacks of servers, right? And his computer was there, and he had a tape piece over his camera. And everyone was like, oh, why Zuck's got tape over his stuff? Yeah.
Still do that.
Yeah. Like that to me is kind of like an indication of when roughly, but also that privacy matters, and it's also no longer a real thing. Like we've lost it in this day and age. You can try to protect some areas of it, and maybe that's what we talk about, but it's gone.
Yeah,
it's definitely different than how I thought of it when I was a kid. I mean, when I was a kid, the internet existed, but not in a real way that it does now. I had no idea what it was. If you had told me about Google when I was 10 years old, it would have seemed magical to me. It was that far off. Yeah. There's no way, but you know, would I have wanted somebody looking at my Google searches if I was being abused? I don't know. How could you use it? What if, you know, Dimitri and I both supervise people, for instance, what if we could access the data of what people were searching on the work computers? Would we do it?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I don't know if I would do it.
I don't know either. I'm just, those are the things.
But I'm like a, I don't know. I have like,
These are things that I've kind of thought about. So I think I would make the decision not to do it. Even if I had the authority to, I wouldn't do it.
I don't think I would.
Just on like a, that sounds like I'm virtue signaling, but I really feel that way.
No, I'm just I'm uncomfortable with it.
Yeah. And there are workplaces that do that. Like I for example, I don't check people's social media.
I don't either.
Like I think that they should be allowed, like as far as work purposes and stuff, like I don't, people need to be, if people want to be, pictures of them having shots with their friends at the bar or whatever, and it's social media and it's for funsies, like that shouldn't influence my decision on whether or not they're a productive person.
I never look at people before I hire them, ever. I don't like, I don't want to know.
But a lot of people, that's like a best practice in a lot of industries now though.
To check the social media. Yeah
I know, but I won't do it. I think they're entitled to that privacy. I personally have taken a lot of shit because I won't friend parents, for instance.
Yeah, like, I don't friend anybody.
Yeah, I don't friend people who work at HLC. If they friend me or something, I would accept them, but I don't judge based on social media. I've also defended to parents. I've had a lot of complaints about staff posting on social media over the years. And they're not allowed to post pictures of kids, obviously, but we had a specific example where a staff member complained about writing IEPs. And it was mild. It was like, oh, I'm so tired of IEPs. And it was like a wine meme, like a glass of wine. And we got phone calls about it. Parents were pissed. And it's her Facebook page. She can post whatever she wants.
Yeah, and everyone's
Y'all back that up like that. That's cool.
Yeah, and it's not like she posted anything terrible about a child. Or
yeah, no one was named. Honestly,
nobody likes writing IEPs. It's not.
Reality not, check.
Yeah.
The worst.
Yeah, she didn't do anything terrible, but we had complaints about it. I'm not willing to use their social media to make any judgments about job performance. But I think a lot of workplaces, like you said, would do it. So then you look at a bigger scale. Should we be making policy based on these things?
Yeah, that's the thing that's terrifying.
Yeah. They probably are making policy and we don't know it.
But then you look at the idea of regulation in general and like the ability to do policies. And Ryan, you just said that, like, can they even keep up with it? And like, I don't know and this is a fun exercise if anyone's interested in like the reality of the ability to regulate social media and or technology. Watch Mark Zuckerberg testify in front of Congress and watch Congress people who are responsible for basically the driving of our entire civilization.
You're saying that the internet is like a series of tubes. And
dude, they were like, wait a second. You're telling me you give this away? You're worth $4 billion. He's like, yeah. They're like, and you give it away for free. Well, yeah. Well, how do you make money? We sell ads. But how do you make money? We sell ads. Like, they could not wrap their brain around the fact that the traffic alone and the actual eyeballs, the attention, is a commodity in and of itself. But really, from a behavioral point of view, going back to that social contingency, what is a potent reinforcer for humans? I mean, social mediation is inherent in verbal behavior. So
attention
is like what humans do. Like everything is mediated that way. So, I'm just pissed off. I didn't think about it first, if I'm being really totally honest. I'm like, damn it.
Which is why I thought of you when I wanted somebody to read the book. I knew you wouldn't be, I think a lot of people would be very, triggered by a lot of what's in this book. And I think it's a hard one to read with a kind of open and critical mind without just freaking out nearly immediately.
Some of the correlates are counterintuitive and they do contrast some of the variety of, like, even social justice concepts that are out there and progressive ideas that people have in relation to what the reality of the facts are, specifically related to how people behave. So it's definitely stuff warranting attention and, like, understanding and knowledge.
Like you said, it's counterintuitive, and that's some of the social justice stuff. We talked earlier about Obama's election night.
But check this stat out. Sorry, before we get too far. SHRM, the Society for Human Resource Management, 2015, 43% of organizations were using social media profiles or online searching to screen candidates.
Yeah, that's bullshit to me.
Yeah, that's crazy. That's I wouldn't do it.
They might as well put a camera on your toilet and watch how you drop a deuce. Like, that's garbage. Like social media is, I mean, especially for someone like me, like, I was in college when Facebook came out. I was in college when I joined Facebook back when you had to have an EDU account to use it. Because actually when it first existed, it was only open to college students. Your parents couldn't be on it.
Yeah.
And you weren't even allowed to have a .com email address to sign up. My login is still my EDU address from college. So
the trend, too, 2011, 13, 15, it went from 67, 68 to 50% said they'd never used it. So the data is also trending to where just more and more and more people are using it.
Because, like, damn, dude, like,
I think
the shit I have there from 2004.
I think he's saying it's going up.
Horrible.
Sorry. Yeah, the number of I switched metrics on you. Yeah. I was saying the number of people who did not use it went from 67, 68 to 50%. Yeah. So more and more and more are using it. My apologies on the switch on the metric there.
So yeah, no way. That's what sucks. Like, I have so much.
See, and this is where I think there's an ideal ethical world to talk about, but then there's the realities. And for me, it's like, I do not have influence over the macro contingencies to be able to influence these sort of things. So why don't we do the best we can with what's going on in our society and culture? And a lot of behavior analysts like flip out over that sort of thing. But my thing is like, what if we did screen based on social media and it decreased our burnout rate in the field? Is that now a situation in which we should be leveraging this sort of thing? What do you think?
Yeah, that's those kind of arguments, though, are like, what if I kill a guy to save, I don't know, someone's feelings? Like, it's
potentially.
I mean, I think choosing between two evils
that could start to do this.
I know, that's why it scares me. That's why we're talking about.
And that's where, like, it could be really cool in helping people out.
How do you decide what is appropriate to use it for, and what's something that it's completely inappropriate for? Who makes those decisions? Right now, whoever has the most money.
Well, right now, Mark Zuckerberg, Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk.
The people with the most money make those
decisions. And the guy who runs Twitter. But I mean, like.
Jeff. Or Jack. Oh,
yeah.
Jack.
Jack. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Jack Dorsey. Jack.
Holler to Jack.
Yeah. Hey, Jack.
Is there a way to do that, though, to decide? Like I was saying, like, wouldn't everybody agree if you can increase intervention for child abuse, that would be a good thing? Is that universal? Would everybody say that? I don't know.
And that's where these types of arguments are difficult. But when you start putting it in contrast to hypotheticals, it's like, do you give up certain types of freedom for certain benefits? Basically, that's the real question we're asking, right? Because with these kind of rules on a macro level, on a societal level, they have to be black and white, right? So vagueity will not be equally applied. Vagueity will permit bias to come into play, which creates more systemic and institutional issues across various groups. So
we have a computer answer this question for us then?
I mean, the computer, yeah, and that's true.
What
I mean,
would the computer say?
Sorry.
Well, what if the computer has comes out with a logical flaw, like a logical answer that the only way to save humanity is to kill us all? Like, I mean, there's a reasonable potential algorithmic output where they're like, you know how we save people from people? We save them from themselves. Wipe them out.
No, for sure. Yeah. No, that's a legit threat that people are worried about.
That's a serious thing.
That they will realize that the way that you do the things that we say we want to do, like
live
in a green, safe world, is you actually get rid of humans.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, the question then is that, like, and again, maybe I'm just not enlightened enough and we haven't achieved that level of philosophical heightened point in any society or civilization, and I'm limited by our times and the parlance and best practices of our times or thought. But I mean, like, you choose, I think, what you value, and you design a systems around that, and you regulate things around that, right? So if we have to think about what is our ultimate purpose as human beings, so then, like, that's a philosophical question, but it's also like it's a question about meaningfulness and happiness and truth and all that other stuff. So it's like, okay, if what I value the most in this world is freedom and choice, right? And that means that I have to accept the negative repercussions of that as well with the positive ones. And I have to think or hope that as a result of that, the positives outweigh any of the negatives, and we do our best to mitigate fallout from those things. I think the biggest problem with me is that the more that you think about setting up, we're like, what if this one good thing happens from this other thing, or this one good thing happens from another thing? But, like, those are all outliers and deviate away from the baseline condition of everyone's life. So, like, do I want to give up the, like, freedom, choice, and privacy that I have for 99.99% of my time and everyone else's time for that 1% possible positive thing that happens? Like, again, I just don't think that, to me, that's my hang up with a lot of this stuff that scares me about it. And, like, but again, the regulation will never occur and is impossible because we have 85-year-old people who, shit, they still don't use the internet. It's been around for 30 years. Like, forget being born into it.
Yeah.
Like, the people who will understand technology that will actually be running the country, that won't be happening for another 30 years. And by then, our robot overlords will have taken over and we won't even have Congress or government. So, like, what's the point? But I'm an alarmist, I guess. So
a little bit.
I was talking with a dog in Norway. Some of us know him from the precision teaching world. And they were hooking. So we were stopped in traffic for this tunnel, and they were hooking up all the sensors to it. And the guy was telling him in Norwegian something to the effect of, like, we no longer have to monitor this thing. Like, there's no human inspector that has to come over. It'll just tell us if something's wrong, and then we can deploy whatever resources that we need. And it got us talking on this topic, and he brought up a cool, interesting point, which was, have we ever really, like, if we're empiricists, right, and we're interested in data, have we ever really tried a society in this such a way? And if we haven't, then maybe we should be collecting a data point.
I mean, I've never tried heroin to know it's a bad idea, though. So, I mean, that argument doesn't really hold water very well. I don't need to shove a needle in my arm and be like, oh, yeah, the data says this is bad for me. I definitely won't do that again.
But,
and then, you know, 3 weeks later, I'm homeless pooping myself somewhere in the corner of Ding. So that's probably not the best move.
A little easier to predict and see what the possibilities are. We're talking about a whole different altered reality and possibility for our species, man.
The thing is, would we ever be able to come into, I think when we're talking about big data too, and he talks about this in the book, he does give the caveat, context is a, you can't just collect a bunch of information and not know the context and use it for good or bad, really, right?
Yeah, that's a great point.
But part of context is that not everybody feels the same. Like, I'm going to hear a data point about, you know, what people look at on Pornhub and be horrified, and you're going to hear it and think it's fine. Like, it's.
I mean, with all fairness, like, looking up ways to convince your wife to act like your mother is a little weird.
We agreed about that one.
We can agree that I'm judging an entire country on that one.
Right. Yeah. Me too. I'm horrified. I'm a little hesitant nowadays. But. That's part of it. No, yeah. Would we ever be able to come to any sort of agreement on anything about what is useful, which parts of this are useful, which are okay? I don't think we'd ever have that. You're talking about, can you give up something for the greater good? I think our society says no a lot of times.
That phrase.
The greater good? You hate it? Why?
Because it's the fallacy of utilitarian thinking when you're describing, like, when you're trying to make these decisions as if there is such a thing as a greater good. Like, who's the greater good? 99 or 98% of people? Like, who's 60% is the greater good? Like, what is it a majority? 51% of the people, if it benefits them, they'll screw the other 49%. Like, that is the kind of thinking that creates these really difficult moral scenarios where potentially we can, like, no one wins.
Except, I don't think it creates them. I think they exist anyway.
Yeah, I mean, like,
the way we talk about it, maybe. True. Yeah.
The electoral college, like,
me calling it the greater good doesn't.
Well, I'm not saying, like, you saying it. Yeah. I'm saying, like, from a moral point of view, like, the greater good.
Is that all
good,
I have,
like,
to do?
Yeah, right. And I just stop talking about it and it goes away. Yeah. Yeah. That's not going to happen. But one of the areas we get a lot of that is the gun argument. We talk about this a ton at our lunches. You know, you'll hear, people are getting murdered all the time. Schools are being shot up, but damn it, somebody might break into my house and I need 26 guns just in case, even though that's not happening. That's not happening.
I mean, I sleep with a gun on my pillow. I don't, by the way. It's a joke.
Oh, God. I'm going to run out of the house.
I don't even own one.
Full disclosure, I don't either. I don't care if people do, but I think that kind of talk is very similar to what we're talking about. Do we give up something that is, you know, people... When I try to explain it to people who don't live here, it's written into our Constitution. That's the biggest argument people will have. They're right. Yeah. It's a part of our history. But, oh, my God, we can't change the laws and make it harder for some people to get guns because it's our right.
Yeah, that's true. Well, we have a right to privacy, though, too, though.
That's what I'm saying. Exactly.
Right to privacy is enumerated as well.
But we don't anymore.
I hate it.
Yeah.
That's where AI is interesting for me because it essentially is – so much faster than law that it's just going to keep taking shit over and making the decisions for us.
That's exactly right? What's happening. It's happening no matter what we think about it.
Yeah. Like there's no legislature in place. And the fastest that our government can move are examples like Cambridge Analytica and the issue that comes from that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And it's still was way too slow, like way, way, way too slow. So
it was a pointless reaction.
I think those are separate, kind of separate things. Like if we're talking about the human's perception on removing guns versus like the possibilities of an AI system, like the AI will move faster is the idea in these paradigms, right? Human behavior versus the AI, like they will move so much faster. That I think is what people are concerned about.
Yeah, the speed of decision making and the ability to aggregate data is what's terrifying because the computational power is like millions of people in milliseconds.
It's before you even have time to think about it. It's already happened.
You're the guy who kills all his friends in the Matrix so he can go back and eat a delicious steak. You're that guy.
We don't know until it's that time, man. I don't plan on it.
We'll find out.
But I don't know how the Matrix works out.
The electrodes in his brain. We'll know for sure.
Oh, man. Yeah, I'm totally out.
No thanks.
What do you guys think about group privacy versus individual privacy? Do you think it's different?
Because
that's what they're talking about. It's not like they could come in and check your internet history. We all know that.
Yeah,
right?
The way he justifies is that he gets it from this huge aggregated pool.
Yeah.
And it's completely anonymized. There's no way to link it to a single person. So he should be able to
use the data.
Does that
make it different for you?
That's how he justified. That's how he got it through IRB too, actually. Because this book is based on this guy's dissertation too.
Yeah.
So it's like
a real study.
That holds some, I don't know exactly where, it does hold a little, I see his argument, I guess, is where I am.
I mean, I
see about a dope dissertation. Right? Yeah, to all behavior analysts out here. Here's a dope dissertation.
He's
way
not
fucking cooler than most of the shit that's going on in our field.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this was super dope. And the thing is that he got a lot of shit for even wanting to do it,
because
all the people were like, this data, how do you control for it? You need to construct your own survey. He's like, the whole point is that I don't want to bias my sample, and I want to see what happens when I just see what everyone's doing in real time without them knowing I'm doing it.
There's
that's
no
the
controls
whole point.
In social research anyway.
Exactly.
That's not a thing.
Oh, what are you talking about?
Yeah, I know that Science came out with something in 2017, which was like a rebuttal to somebody trying to do some Facebook research, and they were saying that's not informed consent. And like, that just goes to show how esoteric the ways are of the peer review system. Like, they don't even realize the level that the rest of the world in these tech realms are operating on, right? Like, even our peer review systems in like the most prestigious journal of science doesn't understand like the implications of the current modern world and the technology.
Well, I mean, and also think about the fact that that data is already in use to make money. Like,
right,
there are people that are aggregating that information, they're extrapolating from it, and they're capitalizing on it. But then on the inverse of that, the people who are charged with plucking out the intellectual power and knowledge that comes from all the different types of practices that those people are engaging with, that in order to inform future generations, right? So the guardians of knowledge are like, we can't possibly study those things, even though those motherfuckers are exploiting
that's
it.
That's what I'm saying, dude.
Like, right? That's the thing. Like, their job is to be guard dogs and document what's happening and demonstrate the correlations and the causal factors that are all within these different things. And like, they're so bogged down by their own bizarre moral compasses and just techniques and methodologies and institutional ridiculousness, IRB, that they lose the forest for the trees. And in the meantime, we continue to get totally raped by giant techno companies. And again, this is where my conspiracy theorist shit comes out. But I mean, like, on the real, like, think about the economic impact all these different things have had across our society. You know, a lot of big topic issues are unemployment, low wages, like the gig economy, all that stuff. Well, I mean, like, what's the most common job for women in America, actually? Retail jobs. Well, guess what? Retail jobs are disappearing because Amazon is continuing to capture 20 to 30% of retail sales on an annualized basis. They're beating Walmart. Walmart is the devil, and they're beating the devil. That's how crazy they are, and they're in a completely automated system. So what happens when those jobs are gone, and the guardians of information and knowledge who are supposed to explain to us these trends and are supposed to see these different relationships and enumerate them clearly,
right,
aren't actually doing that because the sticks are so far up their ass in the ivory tower that they're too good for it? Like,
with Amazon was, is when they convinced people like Toys R Us to put their stuff up on their site.
I know, dude.
Literally signed off your whole company.
It's crazy.
Yeah,
dude. Amazon basically tricked Toys R Us into going out of business. Mm-hmm. And like, they do that.
Not the only one. Like,
oh, every small business.
That 20 to 30%, right?
Yeah. So like, the way that Amazon's model works, for example, this is how they use the buying power and the data, right? So like, small business have to use fulfillment by Amazon. So whenever you buy some type of good on Amazon that's fulfilled by them, but it's not actually sold by them, they take that data point and they collect and they see how the sales are and they see, you know, all the different money they can be made from those seasons, et cetera.
Yeah, and then they try to
Inverse, they'll make a generic, insert it, copy it, and undercut the small business if they refuse to sell to them. And then, ta-da, now they're the number one seller of that item. Number one, other than Toys R Us, Diapers.com. They tried to buy Diapers.com like a few years ago, right? Well, Diapers.com was like, why would we sell to you?
That was your cash out opportunity.
We're Diapers.com. Fuck you, Jeff Bezos. Yep. And Jeff Bezos is like, well, I'm a bajillion quadrillionaire, and I own the largest store on the planet, which is infinitely accessible across every country in the world. So I'm going to undercut you for the next 3 years. And then I'm going to buy you it on pennies on the dollar. And if he could do that with a $300 million company like Diapers.com, like, of course they do it to small businesses constantly. So, like, where's the evil downside of big data? It's the collection, accumulation of power, wealth, and capital. That's the reality of it. So then, like, where does AI fit into all this? Well, that's why they're all investing so heavily in AI, because he who controls the overlords... Yeah, it expedites it, and it puts control over the algorithms.
It's almost like the ultimate multiplier on your capital. You had to work and employ people to be able to like do these sort of things.
Yeah,
and then you had to have like really good really good programmers and people who work that sort of stuff.
Yeah,
at this point, you're going to be able to commoditize your employees. And it's toast, man. It's just
And social media is the same thing with content.
Yeah.
Social media commoditizes all these people who want to capitalize on content creation, but really in reality, what they're doing is crowd surfing, you know, not having to pay TV anchors and cameramen and editors and everything else that a conventional network would have to do, or some other type of content creation company.
Yeah, I only work like 10 hours a day helping them with those sort of things.
Exactly. You work for them for free, bro. Think about that shit.
We know all of this. We know it and we still do it. I just 2 days ago ordered dog treats on Amazon, and the whole time I'm doing it, I was like, Kathy, you're an asshole.
I know. I'm an idiot.
I do it, but it's because...
They have two-day shipping.
I'm almost out of his nighttime treats. I need them. I don't want to go to Target.
Reno has a distribution facility in Reno, so even though it says 2 day, you always get it 1 day. So I'm caught in even a worse thing. I'm like, I'm like, I could just have this tomorrow.
Yeah, great. Then you don't have to run out to the store. We all do it. We talk about how terrible it is, and I'm going to go home and probably order some other random thing I need from Amazon because I do it all the time at work. I use Prime Now at work. I haven't been into Staples or Office Max in 3 years.
Yeah.
They deliver staples, pens, paper.
I've spent 10 to 15 grand on Amazon for the last 3 years straight.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, it's pretty much where I shop.
I don't think people care. I think it's going to keep growing.
Oh, man. All right.
We're all going to contribute to it happily.
So where does this take
us?
Where does this take us?
Shit, I don't know. Read the book if you want your mind blown. There is guaranteed some statistic in there that you'd find interesting. I guarantee that. Not to mention, it was just an engaging book. Like, I didn't mind it at all. Granted, I'm halfway through, but I'm finishing before we release this episode. It was just a time constraint on me. But yeah, I loved it. Takeaways, hopefully OpenAI, things like that are the future of the world. So we have some ethical approaches to this AI stuff. But the fact that Googles are out there and people like them have the capital that they have, like, I don't know. We'll see.
I'm really just banking on like heart disease and climate change killing us before any of this stuff really comes to fruition. So
man,
a solid possibility.
I'm just kidding, man. My high blood pressure will definitely get me before any of those things. Let's be real about that. But I mean, like, yeah, I don't know. The takeaway is just that be careful, be real about these things, and actually start thinking about them in ways to consider your decision making.
Think critically about it before taking it at face value. Yeah. Everybody's lying.
Everybody's lying.
Hey, friend, before you go, please just do us one small thing. Tell a friend, tag somebody, share this with another colleague in behavior analysis. That is the best way you can help us grow. Remember, you can call in on the Anchor app, anchor.fm/thecontroversialexchange. We can actually hear you, reply to that, include them in future episodes. So that is the easiest way to get your voice heard. If you'd like it to be anonymous, just state so when you submit it, and we can make sure that it is completely anonymous as well. Now, another way that you can really help this podcast grow is leaving us a review in iTunes, specifically on the podcasting app for Apple. And it just helps us reach more people. So whether you enjoyed it or not, please leave us a review. That feedback is helpful. Now you can find us on social media by searching for The Controversial Exchange. Typically our handle is Controversial Exchange. However, on Twitter, it is Controversial EX, just because we had to shorten that down a little bit. Now, lastly, there are YouTube videos for every single episode now. We are putting them out there. So please make sure you go check that out, especially if you want to see the visual of like what it is and how we're talking about these sort of things. That will be your place. And one last comment, and that is a quick disclaimer. Now, the views expressed during the Controversial Exchange podcast series are solely those of the individuals involved and do not reflect the official policy or position of any other agency, organization, employer, or company. Assumptions made in the analysis are not reflective of the position of any other entity other than the authors, and since we are critically thinking human beings, these views are always subject to revision, change, and rethinking at any time. Please do not hold us to them in perpetuity. This podcast is to educate and inform, provide discussion, and does not constitute professional advice.